Here in the Green Lab to come on board. And these are Ian Lipkin is the director of the Northeast Biodefense Center and is actively involved in looking at human invertebrate diseases and trying to figure out new pathogens that are popping up worldwide. He in turn brought in the 454 Life Sciences group, including the director of the technology there, to help us with this. So where were we? So back when we were contacted by the beekeepers, as Dennis mentioned before, we were thinking that this was the same old, that we had a varroa problem connected with pathogens. And we have numerous pathogens in bees, as people have talked about. We have the bacteria down here. We have foulbrood, both American and European foulbrood diseases that can wreak havoc in colonies. In Pennsylvania, if you find American foulbrood, the colony either has to be treated effectively or destroyed and burned, the entire equipment destroyed, because this bacteria forms a very temperature-resistant spore. We have numerous viruses that I'll tell you about here that we know that we have in bees. There have been several of these described, as I'll show you here a little bit. We also have the Nosema that you've heard about, Nosema apis and Nosema serrana, with a lot of turmoil and debates situated about what is causing what worldwide in terms of disease. We had the parasites, the varroa mites and the trachea mites that have been introduced to the United States in the late 1980s that have been wreaking havoc and causing tremendous collapse. We also have chalkbrood, which goes through the gut as well, that has been a major cause. We have seen increased levels of chalkbrood disease or fungal disease in bees. So in my lab, over the last 10 years, we've been looking at primarily the viruses, the varroa mites, and the bees, and so the beekeeper called me up to ask me about this. And so we began to look at these, and one of the things that we found was that we could go into these bees and find all the bee viruses that we had capability of looking for. We could find many or some of the bacteria, but we couldn't blame any of them. We also knew from talking with Jeff and Judy that we couldn't really blame Nosema, that Nosema serrana, as Jeff and Judy have shown, has been here for at least 10 years, maybe even longer. And we don't think that it's linked it well with pathogenesis. So working with Dennis and his group, we began to take apart these bees, as Dennis talked about down there, and we began to find symptoms that were described back in the 1950s, 1930s, that we had never seen before. So if I can get the cursor to work here, that this insect, or the bee gut that's down here, if you look at it, it's in a pyloric valve or cardiac region, for those of you who remember your structure function from way back when, we began to see this melanization pattern, or scarring as we've called it. And the old pathology books in bees describe this as being due to a flagellate, a protozoan, and they gave this genus species name, and if you go and look in the literature, it doesn't exist in Web of Science or in PubMed or any other series. We have no record of what this is, and if you go back and look at the description, it doesn't really give us a clear picture of what it is. We also had descriptions of various kinds of yeast infecting the sting gland and causing some of this melanization, but again, we don't have any clue what those particular pathogens are or what they exist with. We also knew that we could go into these bees and do a PCR reaction, try to look for fungi in general, and we found that most of the bees in certain operations, that is these migratory beekeeping entities, that had detectable fungi. We asked if this was chalkbrood, and it wasn't. So that's why I asked my colleague, David Geiser, to come on board. And we began to try to do molecular analysis. In the initial studies of some of the brood that we pulled out, it was looking like we had potentially Aspergillus, that we had potentially Mucor. And when I started reading and looking at Web Science, some of the species that were popping up are reported in humans as increasing infection levels at significant levels, that these infections are associated with immune-suppressed humans, people that have cancer, transplantation, or aging, or also acquired immunodeficiency. And then in the case of Mucor humealis, that some of the cases we've seen death of human due to this fungus alone. And so Dennis at the top right-hand corner over here kept some of the bees on filter paper, and lo and behold, out popped these fungi that looked very much like Mucor. So we had this quandary. We had this very large number of things that we were seeing, but we couldn't blame anything whatsoever. And so we turned over to begin asking about these various hypotheses here, as you've heard about. The top one up here is the one that I tackled, and so the question if we had a new or re-emerging pathogen came to the top. So how do you go look for something that you've never seen before? So Dennis and I happened to make our way down to the National Academy of Science, where there was a talk giving on emerging infectious diseases, and it was both human and agriculture related. And there I got to hear about Ian Lipkin and how he had developed new technologies to look for pathogens. And so it's of reassurance to me as a human being here in the U.S. that he has these technologies, because he's developed ways to look for any known virus and any related viruses of human importance. He has gene chips that have these on there. He has gene chips that have all the bacteria, all the fungi, all the protozoa for vertebrates. And at this meeting, he was talking to a different audience, primarily DOD and NIH. He actually gave a price tag on what it would cost to run these gene chips of $350 a whack. And at the ABF meeting, hopefully I got the initials right here, in Austin of the industry, the National Honey Board was there, and I said, could we potentially get $10,000 to run so many of these analyses of gene chips? And they said, okay, we can do it. So I wrote Ian Lipkin an email, and he didn't toss it out thinking I was a crazy person. He actually responded and came on board, and we have to be very grateful to Ian Lipkin, because the study that I'm about to tell you would never have happened if he had come on board. And he used it as a demonstration of the capabilities of the Biodefense Center. So if you think of bees, they're a very good model system for us as humans. You can think of each colony as being an individual little city or society onto itself, and you can look at diseases across the whole. So what we did was basically went to him, and he also came up with the idea that maybe these vertebrate gene chips weren't the best way, that we needed to take a brand new approach, and that is look at everything that was in these bees, every potential organism that was there. So we did what's called a metagenomic approach. So what we did was we took apart the bee, extracted all the nucleic acid, and then sequenced everything that was there, got rid of the honeybee genes. As Maya talked about, we had luckily had the honeybee genome that just has been completed, that we could subtract those sequences away and leave us with every other organism is there. So we looked at basically plant, viruses, fungi. The plants were the pollen, I have to mention, the bacteria, and everything that was in the bees. We also took the samples that Jeff and Dennis collected, as they talked about, from 10 CCD operations, our historical samples from Penn State. We had healthy bees from Hawaii that don't have varroa mites and that haven't seen the huge pesticide levels that we used as a control. And then we had potential routes of entry into the United States. And this is where we're thinking that if we potentially have a new pathogen, it could have come from outside. As Ian Lipkin has said, viruses know no bounds, that they don't observe international borders. They even can easily move around. So we knew that Australian bees had been imported in 2005, not to point a finger at them, but that was the first legalized importation since 1922, or at least 100 years. And we also had learned that some beekeepers, in order to improve their queen breeding capabilities, were doing what's called wet grafting, that they put a small amount of royal jelly in with the new eggs or larvae into the nurse colonies to get those bees to grow up those larvae into queens. And as you can imagine, going from a cell that has 100 microliters of royal jelly, trying to get large enough amounts to put a teaspoon in each of these cells, it takes a lot of effort and ability. And they found that they had this ready supply of royal jelly being imported in the United States, this fresh royal jelly, as a potential tool. And as Colin Stewart over here will look at me and say, Colin's with APHIS here, that it's not legal, that this royal jelly is not being brought in. It's illegal to use it in this aspect, but it's economically viable here. It saves them a lot of cost. So we knew that they had done this. This is a practice that is also being used in other parts of the world. Yeah, we had learned about that New Zealand, they had banned importation of rail.